Paris News Podcast, episode number 28 for November the 15th, 2009. This week, no Tom again. He is ill. I'm Croc Kamen, but we do have another guest today. We're joined by David Adams, the owner of Earth News.
Hello.
Wonderful. Hello. And you were with us back, let's see, probably was the Apple show before, wasn't it, I think? It was the last time you joined us.
Yeah, see, the problem is with the time changes. I'm the furthest west person who participates in OS News podcast. So that means I have to wake up early on a Sunday morning, which I just don't like to do very much.
What time is it there then?
It's 8 in the morning.
Oh, well, I didn't realize that. Oh gosh, it's sorry, I didn't realize it was that early. Yeah, it's 3:30 here in the evening.
Yes. Yeah, see, the problem is that I actually do have to get up to take the kids to school at 8:00 every morning on a weekday. And so it's not like it's any different than any other day. It's just that I kind of would like it to be different from any other day.
I'm sorry about that.
So that's why I don't do it every day, because usually when these guys are chatting away on the podcast, I'm trying to catch up, trying to catch another hour of sleep. So, but I was feeling ambitious this morning, and I knew that with Tom not being around, I just have to buckle down.
What was I going to say? I don't know. Okay. Oh, glad to have you here. So we've looked at the homepage of OS News, and there's a number of things, but we'll just be covering sort of common ground again if we discuss things like SciStar that's been going on for ages. Instead, we wanted to do a bit similar to the sort of Apple show, to focus on one particular topic, but a very broad aspect of the technology landscape rather than any one particular implementation. So we're going to talk about the mobile landscape, mobile computing, and how that's affecting desktop systems and traditional operating systems, how this is mobile, the move to mobile is changing our life. So it's no one particular story.
Yeah, so this week I submitted a couple of things to OS News, and one of the things that I thought was very interesting is I took a piece of news that maybe wasn't that interesting, and that was the news that Samsung was trying to make a big splash into the mobile, handheld mobile space really what they're doing is rebranding their existing smartphone operating system and starting, kind of opening it up to a larger developer community and just trying to make a splash. And, you know, essentially what the buzz that was generated from it maybe wasn't so much what they were hoping, but this is the seventh major mobile phone operating system on the market right now, and can the industry really sustain seven major mobile phone operating systems? And most people, the conventional wisdom was absolutely not. It's just too crowded.
Well, the key term is the competing operating systems. Sure, the world should be able to easily support any number of operating systems as long as we have the standards to be perfectly interoperable. Really, what we're talking about here is seven different operating systems that strictly do not want to interoperate.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's what the company's individual investment in their platform. In fact, actually, one of the interesting things, no, it's not interesting, correction, one of the very scary things about the move to mobile is how, just like the transition from analog content to digital content, we are losing stuff as we go along. We're losing our rights and we're losing our freedoms as we go along. And the same is of the mobile platform. Because we've got a whole new system, companies can now implement checks that they didn't have before simply because the technology wasn't there before, because the social climate was not the same. So just how badly the App Store is going, and Apple rejecting things for showing pictures of Apple's own icons, despite the fact that they're using an API that was designed to do that on the macOS desktop, and that icon was streamed over the air from the desktop computer to the phone. I mean, where in the world do we get off saying that you are simply not allowed to use anybody else's icon in your application, and if you do, then your application cannot be published to the world? You know, at what point was this acceptable?
Well, one of the challenges I think that the mobile space is facing is that, you know, you kind of mentioned, you know, something about social conventions. That's not the term that you used, but you know, one of the reasons why companies feel like they can get away with restrictions on a mobile device that you can't get away with on a personal computer. It does have something to do with conventions, and that is that the mobile space has been traditionally, really from the very beginning, extremely locked down, unlike the personal computer. And in fact, and this is really ironic, Apple, I think, actually deserves a huge amount of credit for wresting control of the device from the carrier.
From the carrier, yes.
Because traditionally, you know, the earliest smartphones were unbelievably locked down. You know, you could only download apps. You could only download apps from the carrier, and this wasn't universally, but this was very common. You know, the carrier tried to control what ringtones you could have, or what music you could have. The carrier completely controlled the user interface of the device and had their own branding all over
they
it.
They even controlled the hardware itself. You get hardware buttons on the phone that immediately take you off to their stupid rubbishy internet service and charge you a couple of quid, despite the fact you're just for a button press, for an accidental slip. I mean, if we imagine desktop computers under the same way that our internet service providers had total control over our desktop computers and the desktop hardware, well then, next to the E key would be a button that would open up a web browser and go directly to their cruddy, I don't know, music site or something like that, and you'd be billed $2 for that.
Exactly. It would be like America Online. You know, you push a button on your computer and it takes you to the walled garden, you know.
Yeah.
And that was the way that it was. And the reason it was like that is because there was only because the handset manufacturers only had a few customers. Their customers were not the end users. The handset manufacturers exclusively worked for and sold to the carriers. And so the carriers dictated 100% what the hardware manufacturers could do and what software they could put on and everything. And the iPhone, because the demand for the iPhone was so great and because Apple had a certain amount of clout, you know, there was so much buzz for this, they were able to dictate to the carrier that they picked in the particular country, well, we don't care if you have done it a particular way in the past, this is how it's going to be. Now, unfortunately, drunk on its own power, Apple decided rather than to take now its hardware and give the control to the user, it said, oh, well, all this power that the carriers have had, we're going to take it for ourselves. And you know, these kind of shenanigans that the carriers had been doing for years, well, we'll just perpetuate this. I think that the situation that we're in now is quite a bit better than it could have been if the carriers had continued to control it. But it's not nearly as good as the personal computer space, and that's where we all want it.
The iPhone is also, because of that, being able to pull away the control from the carrier, has allowed its competitors to also be less carrier driven. So we've got now, I think this is the age of the branded phone. We've got the resurgence. Rather than the brand of the carrier, it's the brand of the phone now. We're talking about iPhones, and we're talking about the Palm One. It just empty my mind. So there's the Pixie, oh yeah, and the Palm Pre, and now we're starting to talk about the phones directly as these individual single things. Whereas yes, the model exactly. numbers used to be such a throwaway thing. I mean, I can't even tell you what the model number on my phone is, and it's very old, and there's probably, you know, the Sony XYZ281.5 or whatever. They're just these silly names for their phones, and now we're focusing more on the phones as more like computers, and they're becoming more... It's moving a lot less. It seems to be moving slower, as it were. I think it's a good thing. It's starting to focus... it's starting to slow down and produce decent working mobile devices.
Right. So the big splash, you know, public relations splash in the United States right now is with the Verizon carrier is launching their new Android phone, the Droid.
Yep.
And a very good phone, you know, with the latest you know, Android OS. And but again, just like that, they're branding this Droid platform.
Mm-hmm.
And the truth is that the iPhone kind of wedged open the you know, it kind of bent the bars and allowed you know, kind of allowed the lunatics out of the asylum. And so what's going to happen, you know, regardless of what happens with the Apple platform, the lunatics are out of the asylum now, and the carriers have lost they've lost their control, never to get it back, I believe, and so now at least we can have a truly open mobile computing platform. Whether Apple decides to go along with that trend, I think will determine whether they're ultimately successful in the space. I think if Apple tries too hard to hold on to its control, it's going to... Well, I mean, I wrote something a few weeks ago, you know, basically laying out that Apple is in the exact same situation it was in with the Apple II. And, you know, Apple had an extremely open personal computer platform and a dominant market position. And it, you know, Apple made some business decisions about how it was going to control the computing experience with the Macintosh, and it made some decisions that made a lot of sense in a lot of ways, but they ended up losing the market because a more open computing platform was competing with them, the PC platform. And, you know, regardless of how everybody feels about Microsoft, and you know, a lot of people lament the fact that Microsoft and its inferior operating system ended up taking over the world, the reason that it did is very simple, and it was a combination of the openness of the IBM PC hardware platform and the accessibility of the Microsoft platform for developers. And Apple saw its dominant market position decline and decline and decline and decline until it was in the single digits.
Not quite so much. I wouldn't say openness. I think that's a misnomer to say that IBM PC standard ran out because it was of actual openness. I would actually say it's a similar instance of why you've got countries like Korea and China who have like 99% Windows usage. The IBM PC actually succeeded because of piracy more than anything. It was cloned, even illegally, and copied, and the reference platform was so easy to swap things out and so forth, because, I mean, Intel were having difficulty defending their platform in the beginning because of the names, and they had to change to the Pentium, so they had a brand. And mm-hmm. They did sue people about the cloning things, but the damage was done. So I think it really was IBM's lack of forcefulness, which Apple do have, and the fact that basically the IBM platform was pirated until it became common. And so what we're hoping with them, I mean, I think it's ABBA who sung that the history book on the shelf is repeating itself. what we're hoping with Android and WebOS and things like that, these reference platforms are copied enough that it becomes common enough that it just simply outweighs Apple. I mean, with open source stuff like Droid, etc., Android platform, then, you know, the Chinese can knock out a million handsets using this open source software and build up market share that way.
And so my and so my the conclusion that I drew in my essay that I wrote this week about there being room for a new mobile operating system, I kind of bucked the trend among the other pundits out there, and I said, and maybe this is wishful thinking, but I actually think that there's a case to be made for the market being able to handle seven competing operating systems in the mobile space. I think that it can happen for a few reasons. And if there are seven or five or 11 major mobile phone platforms, I think I kind of hope that there are, because if they are, then they are all going to have to toe the line. And Apple is able to get away with some abuses, primarily because it's kind of dominating right now. But if it were one of seven, with kind of rough parity as far as their market share, then there would be a lot of pressure on them to conform to a basic standard of consumer freedom.
Oh, but that is the case almost, because if we let me just pull up Daring Fireball, because John Gruber quoted, now what did he say about the market share, about Apple only having 2.5% of the market share as far as handsets. Here we go. Apple's year-over-year share grew from, am I reading the right thing? Oh, I don't think I want. Where's 2.5? 2.5 search. Here we go.
That's a totally irrelevant figure though,
Yes, but
because the share among handsets overall is irrelevant. I think what matters is the share among the top echelon of smartphones.
well, they've got the mind share, really. That's what I was trying to get at.
Yeah,
They are the
and
little
maybe the
mice,
mind
but
share is more important than that.
yeah.
Because there are a very small number of available handsets that is equivalent in mind share. But even in something that's more objective, there are only a few handsets that really in that upper class,
Isn't that simply because they've just spread, the other companies have spread themselves too thin, in that Apple only sell one phone, an iPhone? They might have different models of it, but everybody talks about the iPhone. They don't talk about the Apple, W22 and the Apple Z1565. It's just an iPhone. They only sell one phone.
Well,
Where is
right.
that with
And
Sony?
the number one and number two handset makers are Nokia and Samsung, but the vast majority of the handsets that they sell are very conventional, kind of boring, handsets, not the, flashy mobile computers that we're really talking about.
Yeah, but you can still be successful with a basic phone if you have one phone and you market that one phone. Because you're talking about mobile platforms, but to be honest, to the end user, they don't see mobile platforms. They just see mobiles. They see phones. They don't see an iPhone running an iPhone operating system. They just see an iPhone. And that's why this paring down of to single brands is a benefit for these alternative mobile platforms, because people are going to see the Droid and they're going to see the Pre, and things like this, rather than a million different mobile phones. So all those mobile phone operating systems have to do is just provide a good experience, and you can have as many mobile platforms as you want, as long as they're providing a good experience and they have a strong brand by which people can refer them to.
So, here's the big question for me about whether the mobile computing market can handle the kind of diversity or the kind of variety or you know, platform diversity that seemingly the personal computer market couldn't. You know, we're looking, if we compare now to the personal computer market, it's we're comparing the PC world of the 80s to now. And, you know, back in the 80s, there were, there were six or seven operating system players. You know, there was Apple, there was Atari, Commodore, you know, Radio Shack, Texas Instruments, Sinclair.
Of course, yeah, it just goes on and on.
There were a lot, and you know, nobody had really broken out to dominate. But there is a huge difference between that world and our world. And here's the here's the first big difference, and that is what was the word? I looked up some of the stats, but there were in the early to mid 80s. There were less than 3 million personal computer users in the world total.
Gosh.
And all of those companies were competing to sell really expensive computers to really 2 or 3 million people. And now there are more like 2 billion personal, you know, so there are 1,000 times more people using personal computers now than there were in the 80s, and there are even more people who use mobile phones than PCs. And so I pointed out with Samsung, you know, okay, Samsung doesn't really have a big footprint in the smartphone market, except perhaps in their home market in South Korea. But so Samsung has a relatively weak market share. They have 21% market share in the overall handset market, but in smartphones they have 4.3%. But 4.3% of the mobile phone market is they're selling 1.5 million smartphones each quarter. So Samsung sells more smartphones in 1 year than all of the Apple IIs ever made.
Yeah,
and that's just Samsung. They don't even compared to the Apple, Samsung, you know, they don't have nearly as big of a share as Apple does. So Apple sells more iPhones in one quarter than they ever sold Apple IIs. So we're talking about a much larger market.
But also, we're talking about different expectations as well. I mean, when you bought a computer in the 80s or 90s, you were making a very heavy investment in a productivity tool. I mean, phones still have the stigma that, you know, what you want to do with them is ultimately make a phone call. And the speed at which people change their phones is absolutely absurd compared to a computer purchase at the time.
Well, that's changing a little bit as we're moving into mobile computing. People are making a more serious commitment to a platform when they decide on a mobile computing device, because, you know, you're buying applications. You are configuring your desktop PC to sync to it. You know, I choose productivity applications on my desktop based on whether they interoperate with my mobile computing platform that I've chosen, which does happen to be the iPhone. And so, you know, that world is changing as people are moving from, voice and text message based handsets to mobile computing devices that are more sophisticated. And then that's one of the things, obviously, that these vendors are banking on. They're trying to make people commit to a platform. But one of the other things that has happened in this mobile computing world is that a couple of major revolutions in the computing world have happened that have totally changed things. And so one of the big kind of 1-2 punch of the computing revolution that I think is probably going to have the most effect on this is the move toward web-based apps, cloud computing, etc. That whole that whole movement has totally changed the landscape that the mobile computing, you know, this nascent mobile computing industry is coming into. And if you look at, I made a list here of probably what I consider a handful of the most useful iPhone applications. And they all have a couple of things in common. Number one, they're all free. And number two, they are essentially just wrappers for web-based services. So essentially, it's just a user interface. Mm-hmm. It's a client server. It's a very lightweight client that runs on the iPhone that's a wrapper for a web-based service. Evernote, Dropbox, Skype, TweetDeck, Yelp, Facebook, YouTube, Weather, various to-do apps, movie listing apps. Those kind of handful of apps right there probably represent 80% of my usage of apps on my phone. And they're all free. I'm sorry, I left one out. My RSS reader is probably my most used iPhone app. Again, just a lightweight interface to a web service. And now, how much lock-in does the iPhone have on me if almost all of my mobile computing usage is on those apps? Not all that much, because all of those, you know, these are either vendors that are making an interface to their own service, such as Skype or Evernote, or they are some developer who is making an interface to an open service, such as TweetDeck for Twitter, or, you know, the weather app that connects to one of the various weather services. And so, you know, if a new mobile phone platform wants to become viable for me, it's relatively easy. I just need apps developed for that platform that connect to those services. And so the kind of lock-in that really kind of ruined the personal computer industry, and by ruined I mean took this wonderful diversity of operating systems and platforms and whittled it down to Microsoft and perhaps Apple and perhaps Linux, if you're willing to have second class citizen status as far as being able to get the productivity or business apps that you might want. That world I don't think is going to repeat itself because of web-based applications and cloud computing and whatnot, and the kind of sacrifices that you have to make today to use an alternative platform are not nearly as acute as they were, let's say, in 1993. Before the internet kind of messed everything.
One, productivity, and two, lock-in. I mean, the lock-in, I think, really, is now down to the experience that you want to you stick to the iPhone because the experience is good. Even though those web-based services you can take everywhere, ultimately with a mobile device you want as little friction as possible with using these apps and services and things like that. And this is one of the reasons why the iPhone has proved so popular. For example, I stick with OS X because I could just as easily use Linux or I could use BSD, but at the end of the day, the experience is what I prefer on this. All of my code and stuff like that runs on open source software. I can take that wherever I want, but I don't because OS X provides me a trouble-free experience, and this is what the mobile phone platforms have to be able to provide. It doesn't matter how many mobile phone platforms there are, as long as the experience is very well polished.
Well, you know, I agree with you 100%, and I'm just thinking as you were talking, isn't that wonderful? Because if people are going to choose a computing platform based on the quality of its experience as the primary factor, isn't that what we have all been wishing for and or fighting for all these years? That you have the freedom to pick the platform that works the best for you, and all those other considerations, you know, just kind of be minor. Because for decades now, that hasn't been the case at all. I mean, you had to pick a platform, you know, based on other factors, based on, you know, business decisions that you had no say in, or you know, that you weren't party to. And I just really wish that the mobile computing, you know, that this new mobile ecosystem could be that way, and that each of these platforms would basically compete on its own merits. And the truth is that you know, I pick the iPhone. Well, I mean, part of the reason that I use the iPhone is because I'm an early adopter, and I started using the iPhone back when it was really the only game in town. You know, it was the game changer, and some of the and none of these other platforms that are now available that I think, you know, are giving it a run for its money were available. So now I just have inertia, but I still think, I mean, I've tried the Android handsets and the Palm and the BlackBerry, and I still, for me, the iPhone's still the best one, and I'm still not quite angry enough at Apple to drop it out of spite. although I could certainly see that happening as the other platforms get better and my spite gets bigger.
It's harder to give things up than it is to simply lose them. Like, for example, Stephen Frank of Panic fame, the OS X software company, tried to give up his iPhone and just found the experience on another platform so bad that it was unquestioned that the iPhone is, you know, you get stuck with it because the experience is so polished and everything like that. And myself, with as a sort of a UI UX person, if software is not well polished, it winds me up something chronic, because I just cannot believe that people actually boot this stuff and say, yeah, that's good, ship it, when there's such mind-blowingly glaring obvious things to me that grate at me every single day. And this is the thing that Apple have managed to do very well with, and that I think other handset manufacturers are just woefully inadequate at the polish on the phone. They really should knuckle down and focus on this a lot more.
And a lot of that has to do with what we were talking about before, which is the fact that the software on mobile phone handsets traditionally has been a total afterthought, that nobody, you know, the handset manufacturers have seen the software as mainly just a delivery service for their branding. And the hardware manufacturers, since they only have a handful of customers, which are the carriers, as long as the software is good enough for the carriers to buy their hardware, then that's good enough, you know, and we poor end users just have to take it. So, you know, we're in the midst of a revolution, I think, where the software is kind of rising to the surface.
And so with this, it's interesting about obviously how Windows Mobile is going, which has been traditionally a cornerstone of mobile computing. If you wanted apps on your phone, then it was more than often than not, it would be Windows Mobile. That was seen as the development platform for mobile phones, bar these sort of dumber handsets that at best had a sort of a badly crippled JM2E implementation. But that how quickly that has changed because of the lack of experience, the lack of proper polished enjoyable user experience on Windows Mobile.
Right, and I think that Microsoft would have been capable of making its mobile operating system better. But had no incentive to, because of the nature of the mobile, you know, the smartphone market, up until Apple came onto the scene. You know, Microsoft was basically just not putting any resources into that, and you know, the bar was so low that it didn't have to really make its mobile operating system very good. And then, of course, what it seems like, you know, history repeating itself, Microsoft once again gets caught with its pants down, you know, it's been resting on its laurels, and something comes along. You know, the last time it happened was when the internet came along and Microsoft scrambled and, you know, eventually, you know, recovered, you know, ended up at least not completely going out of business. And, you know, certainly it lost a lot of its dominance, you know, as a result of the internet revolution. But I think did an admirable job of scrambling to its feet again. Well, I kind of want to switch gears a little bit away from, you know, what we would consider a mobile phone, and into the space of a mobile internet device, you know, up to and including the netbook.
Right.
Because I think that the revolution that's happening in mobile computing is certainly extending into that space, although it's not quite as visible for various reasons. I think one thing is because a lot of people, the mobile computing space and the desktop, or the personal computing space, I think eventually there's going to be a continuum of devices, and they all already exist. It's just the ones that are in between the mobile handset and the kind of the laptop. There's a couple of spaces there that people are trying to fill in with devices, but they're just not catching on.
Hmm.
I think that, you know, we have the legendary tablet computer, which vendors have been trying for decades to come out with a tablet type computer that's going to succeed in the marketplace, and just none of them have. But one of these days it's going to happen, because well, I mean, a couple of things have happened. There actually is an extremely successful tablet computer. It's just that it's very small. It's the iPhone. The iPhone is a very successful tablet computer. It's just small enough to put in your pocket, and that's what people needed. And in fact, Apple used to make a very, very good tablet computer for its time, which was the Newton MessagePad 2000, which I was quite a big fan of back in the day. And when Apple discontinued the Newton, it was a long time before there was another device that really held a candle to it. But it was a niche product, because the killer app for a tablet computer, it was ubiquitous network. And until 3G based network was available as a feature, as an affordable feature, it was impossible for any kind of mobile internet device to exist or to have a real market. And one of the problems with the Newton was that not only was there no 3G internet, there wasn't even Wi-Fi. You know, Wi-Fi didn't come out until maybe a year after the Newton was discontinued. So how I had to get on the internet with my Newton was I had a PC card, modem, and an Ethernet card, and I would literally plug in and use the internet on that, on my tablet PC, and it seemed extremely extremely futuristic to do that. But so now the technology has come around to provide that essential thing, and the question is, you know, do people want a way of doing computing and accessing the network on the go that is either bigger than an iPhone or smaller than a small laptop? And the answer is still, to some extent, not really. at least not at the price point that people are charging for that kind of device.
Yes.
And, you know, I've often said that the thing that will push me personally into that space is if someone comes out with a tablet computer that's around a 10-inch screen, I'd say somewhere between a 7 to 10-inch screen that I can carry around like a book, that I can use like people use a Kindle. I don't have any interest in a Kindle myself. It's not general purpose enough, but the form factor is good, and I actually read ebooks on my iPhone all the time. But the screen on the iPhone is a little small. I read, you know, whether it's RSS feeds or ebooks or whatever, I'm reading on the iPhone all the time. But the screen's a little small. For around the house or in bed in the evening, I wouldn't mind having something a little bigger. So the minute somebody has a tablet form factor that's larger than an iPhone that I can carry around with me, that I can also put on a little stand and connect to a keyboard and use as a laptop when I want to, as soon as I can get one of those for around $500 that I can get for cheap laptop money, it doesn't have to be netbook money. It can be more than $300. It can be more than $200, but it can't be more than $600. As soon as I can get one, I'll buy it.
Well, people,
and I think I'm not the only person who would be in the market for a device like that.
People do not know what they want until you show it to them. And I think what the mobile computing space has done for the market, for personal computing in general, is moved the pointer along to experience being an important factor more than the generality and the ability to run any old software you want, or the freedom basically of traditional desktop computing. Traditional desktop computing, etc., has limited the scope of the mobile computing platform because of its complexity, like Windows, basically the Windows mobile paradigm of mobile computing. Okay, that's an old e-world paradigm of mobile computing, and it's just a poor experience and it doesn't work. What as I say, if you need to show people what it is they want and make it easy, make it interesting, and they'll give away their freedoms for that if they can just browse the web. They won't care if they can't do this or that with it, but if it's a really good web browser, then it will suit a particular purpose, and they will use it. And I think this is beginning to happen with netbooks now as well, because what we're seeing is now new operating systems that basically move netbooks away from being extremely general computing devices where you have to be extremely knowledgeable with computers to get them to do everything you want by using traditional Windows and traditional Linux, into what, as you know, the smartbook category, whereby we do not use traditional operating systems, but we focus on the experience and make these things do one thing very well. You've got the Chrome OS on the way, you've got Android, Microsoft are even trying to get in the game by just rehashing Windows CE. So you're losing a lot of the freedoms of the genericness that you gain with a traditional operating system like proper Windows or proper Ubuntu or something like that, into these customized experiences. But that makes the product easier to use for a person, and it also makes it easier for them to perceive how they can use that product to fit into their life. Because if you give them a device and you say, this is a computer and it can do anything in the world, well, they are so mesmerized by the possibility of anything that they don't know what to actually use it for.
Right,
but if you show them a really good web browser, it doesn't matter that it can't do anything else or that it can do anything else, it's a really good web browser.
Right, well, I mean, if you look at the typical personal computer user, and you know, what do they actually use their computer for?
And it's
well, it, you know, and you know, this is funny. As I was saying the words typical internet user or typical personal computer user, I was thinking, you know, we are, you know, we the kind of the technological elite,
yes, If you're listening to this podcast, you fall into that category.
You know, we're kind of an arrogant bunch. You know, it's just like political pundits, you know, talking about Joe Sixpack, you know, or talking about, you know, your typical voter. And what they mean when they say typical voter is stupid person. But, you know, but as I was thinking that, as I was thinking, you know, typical PC user equals stupid person, I was thinking, well, you know what, though? I'm an atypical personal computer user. But guess what? I use my computer to browse the internet, you know, 96% of the time. And the truth is that if I were to have you know, one of these kind of netbook or, you know, mobile internet devices that was only a web browser, I would be totally fine with that.
Yeah. This is where Chrome OS will work.
Now, of course, you know, because I'm in the technological elite, that also means that I have like 7 computers in my house. And so if I do need to edit some video or, you know, run a mathematical simulation, yes, I have, you know, a quad core desktop machine that, you know, that I can, you know, use that with, you know, and I have devices, you know, running various versions of either Linux, Windows, or Mac OS, or, you know, in my house. And, you know, I can do that. And the truth is that the market, certainly the early adopter market for all of these kinds of devices, are people who already have other general purpose desktop computers and are going to still have them. Mm-hmm. And I think that's one of the reasons why, you know, not every computing device in your house has to be a fully functional personal computer.
Not every operating system has to run Photoshop. Basically.
Exactly.
It's not useless. And
I'll give you a good example. One of my computers, you know, I guess I'll put computers in air quotes, I have a Linux computer in my house that is a network attached storage machine. But it's, you know, I wrote a review on it on OS News. It's a very fancy one. It runs Linux, and I can make it do all sorts of cool things. You know, for example, it has a BitTorrent client. So if I want to download something, I can download it onto my NAS, so I don't have to have BitTorrent. I can turn my other computers on and off, and I won't lose my BitTorrent because I leave my NAS on all the time. And so, just because it isn't a fully functional Linux-based personal computer that has doesn't mean that it isn't super useful. And, you know, one of my quote-unquote personal computers is my iPhone, which doesn't do everything that my laptop or my desktop machine does, but it certainly does everything that I need it to do in order to be useful to me. So here's the other question, I guess, you know, as we're kind of talking about the typical computer user and kind of paring down, maybe not paring down the capabilities, but paring down, because in a lot of cases, these kind of, what was the term that you used? Smart books?
Yes.
In a lot of cases, if you have a good kind of a app store type of experience for these things, you know, you take one of these Linux-based smart book type of platforms, and as long as there's an app store type of place where developers can make a customized app that you can install easily for it, pretty much. You know, the future is open for you. It's not like there's anything, you know, you're really only limited by the hardware. I mean, the iPhone, you know, as long as Apple isn't interfering, you know, the kind of apps that I can get for the iPhone, you know, it's a little crazy. There's all sorts of crazy stuff that you can do on this that there's apps for. And, you know, I mean, I can run a terminal app, and I can do all sorts of stuff. I can run a remote desktop app, and I can, you know, connect to stuff. I mean, it's a little computer, and there's all sorts of, as long as Apple isn't interfering, I'm not really limited. I'm limited only by the hardware. I'm limited by, you know.
But you're also limited by the apps that you install are self-contained. A lot of things they can't change. The main UI of the phone. You can't change the dialing interface, and you can't change the springboard and things like that.
Yeah.
They're just their own little contained experiences, which is perfectly fine for most cases, but we're missing out on a lot of innovation here because of that inability to question the status quo there as to get the whole computer market in improving the experience for everybody. So the iPhone is still a very closed sort of device, and really that's the difficult thing, is Apple don't like other people choosing their functionality.
And with this kind of smart book ecosystem, I think that there's going to be the same challenge, because you know, even if you have the most open platform available, at some point you are limited by the fact that you will break the environment.
Yes.
You know, at some point you'll take this kind of Linux-based specialized operating system and user interface, and at some point you could break it so that it doesn't work that nice kind of elegant, easy to use way. And essentially you've turned the computer back into a general purpose, you know, somewhat difficult to use Linux desktop environment. Because you know, you've kind of broken out of the sandbox. So yeah, I agree that is going to be a challenge.
I'm majorly concerned as to some of these smart books. That seems to be, it's just too early, isn't it? Because a lot of this seems to be very misguided. I don't think the OEMs really know what they're doing. In fact, Android is not really a desktop operating system, and it's kind of quirky and odd to use because it's not on a handset with a traditional keypad navigation, and Windows CE, well, certainly that's hardly appropriate for a good user experience. This is why I'm particularly interested in Chrome OS is because I think that Google really understand what they want to do here, and I think that will really help push the OEMs in the right direction, because I believe that netbooks have not truly become netbooks yet. They haven't actually reached what they're supposed to be. The OEMs have been fumbling around with this highly successful device, but they don't actually know what it's for, or how to build them correctly, or how to design them correctly. They've just been whacking things together in small form factors and shipping them out of the door. We haven't had a cohesive design, a statement to say, this device does this thing, and it is honed to do this particular task. I think that's probably
right.
What we're going to get with Google cooperating with the OEMs and with Chrome OS, an operating system that will focus on being good at browsing the internet, what these netbooks should be doing, and hopefully also just ubiquitous networking becoming very common in these netbooks.
Right. I think the problem is, what you're putting your finger on is that the cooperation from the hardware side and the software side isn't happening, and there's a very simple business reason for that. Microsoft is extremely ambivalent about this whole trend, because essentially Microsoft has no way of getting the kind of money that they're accustomed to get for their operating system in this space. The profit margins are just too slim, and so Microsoft has been happy to kind of play along for now by basically dumping crappy old licenses for Windows XP, into this market, there's an important turning point where Microsoft now is no longer interested in putting XP out into the market anymore, and is also not interested in selling Windows 7 at the price points that it was willing to dump Windows XP. And so, you know, Microsoft, I think, you said that, you know, Microsoft is going to be interested in coming out with a new operating system specifically for this space. And I agree that that's almost certainly what they're going to do, because they don't want to give away Windows 7 to you know, at those kind of low prices. But I think that they're going to be so crippled. They're going to have their hands tied by needing, for business reasons, to deliver a semi-crippled operating system.
Yes.
That's going to be a problem.
Windows 7 Starter Edition, which is a crippled version of Windows 7 with various hardware restrictions on it. But again, it's not the same price as what they're throwing away Windows XP. Basically, this is the crux of what I believe. I believe Windows is becoming irrelevant. Microsoft Windows, the product, is basically becoming completely irrelevant, and Microsoft are scrabbling to find relevancy in this market now. Netbooks are beginning to move away from x86, or beginning to move away from Windows into new customized experiences. We've got ARM, etc., and things like that, which are going to, hopefully, as long as the OEMs can get their act together, is hopefully going to promise us hardware and features in the hardware that x86 will never be able to offer. And ergo, right, likewise, that Windows is never going to be able to offer. And because we're all doing everything so web-based, again, Windows is becoming pretty much irrelevant. It's too big. It just doesn't shoehorn into these things. It doesn't give it a good user experience at all. It's got so many problems. And all Microsoft have got to offer is Windows CE. It's basically Windows Mobile and Windows CE, and it's laughable. It's a complete joke.
Right.
And they're going to have to just hovel something together to try and compete in this place. It's why Windows CE is appearing on these netbooks in the first place, when you've got much better experiences, although I still don't think as good, like Android. And I think Google with Chrome OS are going to solve this one outright.
They're not
going to ship. People have said that, been worried about compatibility with Chrome OS when Google do announce it. But I think Google Chrome are not going to pull a desktop Linux. They're not going to just ship a shoddy experience, a generic shoddy experience, and say that users have to deal with it and have to drag themselves along. They're going to ship a very highly polished experience that is only limited to a very subset of netbooks, and they will expand that over time with OEM licensing.
So there's another kind of business related aspect that's hobbling this nascent part of the industry, and that is, on the hardware side, you have Intel. And Intel is terrified that the market is going to move over wholesale to these, you know, lightweight devices that they don't earn a lot of money on. Intel has created a very, very nice platform in Atom.
I wouldn't really say it was that good. I mean, it's good as far as the history of Intel goes. You know, they've managed to get somewhere with it, and they've managed to take a x86, which is inherently a bad design, and shoehorn it down to a small enough size and power production. But it doesn't.
Right. I mean, as far as I'm going to say, very good
for Intel.
It's very good for a miniature laptop, miniature x86 laptop, which is something that the market really wants. The market wants a power-sipping, small form factor, inexpensive mini laptop motherboard and processor combo. So Intel has a nice one that a lot of people want. But what have they done? They have limited. They don't let people ship mini laptops with more than a gig of RAM.
And
it's not like the cost of the RAM is a factor in, you know, another gig of RAM, you know, and on wholesale is what, like $2, $3, you know, you don't have to add any cost to the price of a netbook to have 2 or 3 or 4 gigs of RAM in there. But Intel doesn't want that to happen because they don't want. They want these machines to not be as good as a proper laptop.
Yeah. And by that, you're just selling out the users by purposefully giving them a crappy experience. And this is why I think they're going to ultimately lose. Because the ARM platform is going to be able to offer hardware capabilities that Intel cannot touch unless they literally switch to producing some ARM chips, which they're fully capable of doing other than hurting their own pride.
Right, right.
You know, we've got like what Nvidia are doing with the Tegra,
and so your audio is breaking up on me a little bit. Is mine?
No, you're good. Do I sound okay?
You know, and then of course, you know, people have been agitating that, you know, why hasn't Apple delivered anything in this space. You know, this wide gap between the iPhone and the and their smallest iBook, or their smallest, you know, MacBook or whatever. And of course, it's all about the same thing. All of the existing players are too concerned about cannibalizing their own markets. And of course, you know, anybody who is involved in the business world can identify this phenomenon. It was outlined in a very popular book called The Innovator's Dilemma that, you know, most kind of business people have heard of, and it's this issue of disruptive technologies. And, you know, the reason why upstarts are able to come in and unseat established players is in large part because the established players are always too concerned about cannibalizing their own existing revenue sources, you know. Yeah. And so what happens is they allow themselves to be completely unseated by someone else, you know, who's basically coming in clean. That's what a disruptive technology is. And I do believe that these kind of ARM-based networks, yeah, netbooks are going to prove to be a disruptive technology. And if you haven't heard about this Innovator's Dilemma, this Clayton Christensen book, one of the interesting case studies that he brings up that will resonate with people like us is the issue of hard drives. And every you know, hard drives have gone through these progressions where they've gotten, each time they get smaller and smaller. And each time the hard drive form factor goes down to a smaller form factor, the previous dominant player totally loses out. Because they've made a commitment to the larger form factor, and each time the smaller form factor becomes dominant, the vendor of the larger one poo-poos the newer, smaller one because it's not as good as their older, bigger one. It's not as fast. It's not as whatever. And you know, and you know, the that's currently happening in storage in the move from mechanical hard drives to solid state drives.
Yeah.
Which aren't as good. They're quote unquote, they're not as good, they're not as good.
Yeah. So where you normally have your Hitachi, your Western Digital and your Seagate, is now beginning to move to, you've got your OCZ, J Micron, who do the controllers. All the companies are new, they're different. All of these SSD, the biggest SSD players who make the best quality SSDs, are all different companies from the traditional hard disk, HDDs providers. And this is how I see x86 as well, ARM as well. ARM is a reference platform. You can buy a license and anyone can produce an ARM chip. So you have that ability for a system to be cloned, and we don't have these people do not have a reliance upon Intel to produce the chips for this, and Intel dictating what the hardware should and shouldn't do because of their bottom line. And so this is why I think ARM has a real good chance of one, unseating Intel in the netbook area and smartbook area, etc., but also two, basically unseating Windows and making Windows even more irrelevant than it is by introducing newer operating systems that are more diverse, that are more iPhone-like, that focus on the experience, and we've got the big players like Intel and Microsoft who business is geared up to the old way of doing things and just fiercely do not want to change, they're going to be left behind unless they embrace this stuff.
Right, and the funny thing is, going, you know, back to the hard drives, what you mentioned, it's no secret. This thing with the hard drives, with the existing players getting unseated by the upstarts, it's happened 5 or 6 times before. You know, starting with when hard drives were the size of washing machines, and you know, moving down, and it's one of the most famous examples. I mean, they teach it at every business school in the world, this issue with the hard drives. Everybody knows it's happening, but even though everyone knows it's happening, the existing players are there, they are powerless to prevent it. And I think that Intel, in the same way, and Microsoft are perhaps powerless to prevent themselves from falling prey to this, because because they can't embrace the new way without destroying their existing business. And there's just no way that a company, you know, that a large publicly held profitable company can afford to burn down its old business in order to not get outmaneuvered in the new business. It just can't happen. And you know, so whether or not that's a tragedy or something to be celebrated, I guess depends on where you're sitting. But you know, I just hope that whatever happens, it ends up being a step forward for the users.
Yeah, that's what matters, the end users in this. It's just interesting to know, because lifetime, as I've known it for the computing environment, has always been Microsoft and Intel dominated. Always, it's all I've ever known, and it would be very interesting to see something completely new, to see a transition from one giant to another, to see this bell curve of crossing curves of where we get new technologies like SSD introduced and they pick up and they become the dominant thing. And I'd like to see a world where we don't have Microsoft as the main operating system vendor, just to see what it's like. Is it going to be better? Is it going to be better for users? Is it going to be better for freedom? Because it's, right. You know, Microsoft not being the best, not being the best at honoring freedom, let alone, you know, at least the Windows operating system does allow anyone to develop for it. It does allow a certain amount of freedom of what you run on it.
Right. So the other article that I wrote this week was about this. You know, I saw this review that somebody else had done of an $80 ARM-based laptop. And, you know, it looks like this particular device is kind of crap. It's too slow. It's too slow. Those are basically its three major problems. You know, it's a micro laptop, 7-inch screen, ARM processor, not very much RAM, you know, not very much memory of either kind. It runs Android, I think it runs Windows CE, but it can also run Android. Yep. And, you know, it has all of those problems. You know, it has software problems, it has hardware problems. But I think that it's noteworthy because of what it represents. And there's some new processors, or a new processor from ARM that's in the works, the ARM Cortex A8. Which should be 5 or more times faster than the, what was the processor that was in this one? The ARM, ARM...
Are you talking about ARM A9s?
ARM
A8s are the current ones, and the A9s are the next generation ones, up to 1 gigahertz, including the capability of dual core.
Right. So, you know, so we have this current, but, you know, Moore's Law inexorably marches forward, and so I don't think it's going to be very long before there is an ARM processor with acceptable performance.
Yes.
for a small handheld computing device or a micro laptop sized computing device. I don't think it's going to be very long at all. As long as they can do it without wrecking the power consumption, which is a huge issue, because one of the ways that you make a small computing device cheap is, well, the components have to be inexpensive to begin with, but also they have to not depend on other expensive components. So, for example, they have to have cheap batteries. And so cheap batteries are batteries that don't have a lot of capacity. And you can't have a machine without a lot of battery capacity unless it doesn't use that much power. So, I mean, there's kind of a whole cascading thing. You know, but I think that it's not going to be too long before there is a $100 micro notebook or tablet or convertible type of device that has a perfectly acceptable performance and battery life.
Yeah. We're seeing together here the emergence of the hardware and also the emergence of the software. Now, as I say, with the diminishing dependence upon Microsoft Windows and desktop OSs in general, I should add, we're also seeing now the capability for us to get our work done on operating systems that are not tied to x86. Okay, so if we've got a web browser, and you know, thankfully we no longer rely upon Microsoft to port Internet Explorer to ARM in order for us to get work done,
Exactly.
then I think that within 3 years' time, we'll be seeing full 15-inch powerful ARM-based computers running maybe some future version of Chrome OS or Android, or even Palm's Web OS, etc. And we'll move completely off of Windows. We'll have a greater diversity of choice of what processor we have, and we've got a choice of what operating system we run. But what we really care about is getting work done, the experience, being able to run our websites we care about.
Yeah, I think you put your finger on it because you know the wedge into the door is going to be these small,
Yeah, exactly.
lightweight
It might be crap
devices.
now, but you know, they are the
But
sign of th
yeah,
things to come.
they're going to move up market as
They're
the
the
as their capabilities
they're
improve. And I'll tell you, Intel is terrified of this happening. They do not want
they
this
are
to
the
happen.
SSDs of the
And
HDD world.
Microsoft.
Yeah. You know, these ARM things, they are slower and they are crapper in every way, etc. But the promise is there that they will be better. You know, like you've got hard drives, you've got the mechanical, the moving part, and the SSD. The benefit of the SSD is it doesn't have moving parts, but everything else about it isn't as good. Well, Moore's Law dictates that eventually it will be better, that it will eventually be better than hard drives, but also having the benefit of no mechanical moving parts. The ARM is the same thing. The ARM is it's not as good as the current generation of Intel chips and so forth, but it has the one benefit that it's got ultra low power requirements. So when all the other factors are sorted out just by purely by Moore's Law, then you have something that is better than Intel chips, and so therefore the market is going to go that way.
Right. Well, so before we wrap this up today, I wanted to bring up one more thing that's related to this, and that is, okay, you know, we're talking about these inexpensive small devices moving up market, but let's talk about how the computing world can change, not from these small cheap devices, you know, getting better and moving up and becoming more expensive, but by moving laterally into markets that haven't had good access to computing because of the cost, and what's going to change. You know, I brought up in this article, I've read recently about how revolutionary the mobile phone, you know, regular old crummy cheap mobile phones have been to the developing world. And you know, essentially as a communications device, you know, both for voice and text communications, you know, basically, you know, taking remote villages of and connecting them to the larger world, and what a huge revolution that has been for commerce
Oh, I
and for
mean, they even have
communication.
banks that you can do your banking entirely by SMS. You can go into the middle of nowhere in a village in Africa, and you know there will be several mobile phones there. People walk 2 or 3 miles to go get their mobile phone charged. Mobile is massive in Africa, absolutely massive. It is democratizing a lot of things for people, and it is an absolutely central part of their life now. Even even the relative just how poor people are there, even then, you know, the mobile network is still more so. I mean, they use SMS and things to do more than what even we do with SMS.
Right.
They do art, they publish novels, they use it for banking, they use it for credit transactions and actual payments even now. It's the whole SMS and way mobiles are integrated into society in Africa is far more advanced than what we do here. We piss about with apps on our phones. They are actually running their lives with them.
Right, and nobody is so poor that at least now the prices have moved down to the point where no there isn't anybody in the world that's so poor that it makes more economic sense for them to walk a week in order to be able to give somebody a message than it does for them to be able to give that message electronically. The prices have moved down to where everybody can afford to send a text instead of walking through the wilderness for a week in order to deliver the message, yes. Which is what people used to have to do. And that's why it's been so transformative. These people have gotten a week of their life back that they can use farming instead of walking in order to deliver that important message. But they're not using... they're not using a cheap mobile phone as their platform because the cheap mobile phone is the best form factor. They're using it because that's the thing that's accessible to them. But if you have $100 laptops that, you know, connect to these networks that are already proliferating, you know, these mobile phone networks and mobile data networks, if the $100 or the $80 or the $50 laptop is suddenly available, it's now within reach for, you know, the village entrepreneur,
yes.
to give these greater capabilities, to the people, you know, that are their customers. And it will continue this trend, this radical transformation that's happening will continue, and people will have more.
Yeah.
We'll have a better tool to be able
to
do
it. We have to put this in context of the West, the developed world and the developing world, in that this $80 laptop, etc., might be crap to us because it's slow and we can't run this particular website or anything. All we do is piss about, as I say, with these things. To them, an $80 laptop that can get onto a network, no matter how slow it is, that's life changing. That allows them to start a business, it allows them to take control of their own life and their own income, and it allows them opens up entire new possibilities for this world.
Right, and just look at what people are doing with a display on a mobile phone, you know, of three lines of, you know, 22 characters of text, a seven inch screen on a cheap laptop is certainly certainly yeah. better than that, and so it's not just about, like I say, you know, kind of moving up, you know, for kind of dilettantes who want to be able to read web pages from their couch. you know, there's a tremendous amount of world productivity that can be affected as we move these devices down and allow them to access new markets that are just, you know, completely inappropriate for our current crop of you know, full-sized computing devices. Mm-hmm. So it's all quite exciting.
Yeah, absolutely.
And you know, I'll say it again, you know, in a website that covers operating systems, the kind of the stasis that the desktop operating system world seems to have had, you know, with Windows dominating and you know, kind of niches of Mac and Linux, that's kind of boring, and I'm certainly glad that it looks like, you know, it looks like there are some things that are really going to be shaking up this world over the next few years. I don't think that the Mac, Windows, and Linux desktop environments are going to go away.
No.
They're just going to be, you know, some cornerstones of a much, much larger computing world. And could we ask for anything better? I mean, I think that's what we all want.
Yes. It's like the question that you've got 1 billion people on the internet. What happens when you add another billion that can gain access to the internet? What possibilities does that open, and how to get those 1 billion, you know, other people on the internet? So definitely we're going to see a globalization of computing hardware, because we're not, this is still very developed, Americanized world of computing. And so whilst we've had a globalization of the world in general, the world has become a smaller place, the computing landscape is still very lopsided, and hopefully this ever-cheaping equipment, and also equipment that people can design and build themselves and not be dependent upon Intel to these things. You know, India could develop their own processor or license ARM and start producing their own equipment, etc., in their own culture, which I think is important to add. This other billion people coming online is going to radically shake up how we perceive and use the internet, I think.
Well, I think that's a good place to wrap it up for today.
Okay.
What do you think?
Yeah, of course, we've talked for long enough. Thank you for listening, everybody. And if you've got anything you'd like to add, or anything you'd like to point out, any viewpoints, of course, your own opinion, that's what matters, please reply on the thread on osnews.com, or, of course, you can email us at crew@osnews.com. And I think that's about all left to be said. Thanks very much, David, for joining me today. That's very kind of you.
Thank you.
Glad we had this discussion. I think that turned out very well.
Okay.
That's all to be said. Thank you, everybody, and we hope to see you next week as well.
Bye-bye.
Bye.